If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440, or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema, all lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Okay, people, welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 77. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, I'm doing a few different things. One of which is I've got a little bit of a chat I put together with Sal. I've got myself a brand new mixer for my audio files, and to test it out and to play around with it just a little bit, Sal and I had a chat. So I'm going to play that in just a few minutes, and the movies I'm doing this week are, he said, thinking about it very, very carefully, Coffee from 1973, starring Pam Grier, and Charlie from 1968, starring Cliff Robertson and Claire Bloom, one of which is science fiction. I won't even make you guess which one. It's the second one. So, how are you? We're doing fine here. It's winter, which is not so fine, and I'm not going to bitch about winter again because I do that fairly consistently every podcast that I do during the winter months, but I'll kind of eschew that for a moment. I have been doing the radio gig, which is a lot of fun still, and I continue to enjoy the fuck out of doing that as well. The two movies I've talked about most recently on that are The Red Shoes, starring Moira Shearer, Robert Helpman, Anton Walbrook, and Marius Goring. And I did Mad Max most recently. Next one I'm going to do on there is one I've already done for the podcast, which is The Court Jester. So, yeah, that's going along nicely. Ivor's back from holidays, and so we're grooving with doing that gig. It keeps me fairly busy too, because I want to make sure that I do that fairly well. It's okay making fun of yourself and making an idiot of yourself in front of a podcast audience is another thing to do it to any number of thousand people covering an area somewhat larger than Texas. So that's going well. I'm getting good feedback from that, and I'm really enjoying that as well. Yeah, I've been watching a few films and things like that. One of the things I did do today, which was a lot of fun, once the hassles with Skype were overcome, and you know that happens occasionally, is that I guested on Brian's Hammickus podcast. So we Skyped it from between right across the Pacific Ocean, talking about a movie called Maniac, but I'll leave Brian and his podcast to cover that for us. And that was a bit of fun too, getting in touch. It takes a little while to get used to Skype when you're recording on it, as a lot of podcasters will know. But it was fun, and Brian and I seemed to get along nicely, and we really enjoyed doing it. So that's one of the reasons why I'm recording this a bit late. I went out, did the household stuff, and then popped over to the market, came back again, popped out to another market, came back again, had a bit of a half an hour of Skype hassles, and then did the Hammickers podcast. So if I'm sounding like I've got no energy levels tonight, I'm actually doing this 5:30 p.m. I'm starting to do it. But if I have no energy levels tonight, let me know and I'll go and get a cup of coffee, all right? So what have I been watching? Let's crank up Mizzo and it will tell me what I've been watching. By the way, when I'm heading in that direction, I am going to do the Red Shoes of the podcast, I've decided. Fantastic film I saw it for the first time a couple of weeks ago when I was reviewing it for the radio. And when I get to the R's, the Red Shoes is on it. And I had a recommendation from a co-worker, which is really unusual for me. And that was, in this case, for the S's. So I'm kind of anticipating the A to Z project that I'm doing, going each for podcast, talking about a different letter of the alphabet. We're up to the C's, of course. But when we get to the S's, I'm going to do Shane the Western with Alan Ladd and Van Heflin. So I'm looking forward to that as well. Let me have a look here. I'll go down through the list. So, of course, I watched Maniac that I'm doing for the podcast with Brian. I watched Due Date, to the recent movie with Zach Galifianakis and Robert Downey Jr. I've actually learned how to say Galifianakis too, which is quite a skill. I kind of liked it. It's one of those comedies of discomfort where one of the characters is hideously embarrassing and the other one's mainstream. It's a little bit like Planes, Trains and Automobiles, only better, because I think that that particular John Hughes movie did descend into bathos a little bit, whereas Due Date kind of bounces along nicely and shows you lots of interesting things, including Zach Galifianakis masturbating. Well, you don't see that, but it's implied. And how to break through the US-Mexican border in a four-wheel drive. So, you know, never a bad thing to learn. And, yeah, Sal and I both enjoyed that one. It was a bit of fun. What else have I seen that was interesting? I watched Robocop 2. I haven't watched it for years and years. I watched Robocop 2, which I believe had a script done partly by Alan Moore. Was it Alan Moore or was it not Alan Moore? Let me have a look. I'm going to have to look this up now. Great. See, I need the coffee now. I'm going to, as soon as I get the first break in this podcast, I am definitely getting myself extra Java. So, was it Alan Moore or not? It may not have been. Frank Miller. Sorry, my mistake. Frank Miller did part of the script for Robocop 2. And there's a couple of very Frank Miller kind of bits in it, including the Elvis memorabilia that the bad guys have, which is quite an amusing little piece of stuff. And, Robocop 2, it's a Robocop movie. And, I enjoyed it just for the mad kind of action and stuff like that. I did see The Lovely Bones as well. I had that on the PVR and I watched The Lovely Bones and not comfortable with that. I think Stanley Tucci's excellent in it. And they even get a bit of good acting out of Mark Wahlberg for a change. And Susan Sarandon in it's pretty good. And the young actress, Saoirse Ronan, who plays the dead chick, is good, but I'm kind of, that afterlife kind of stuff doesn't sit well with me for philosophical reasons. I'm not good with afterlives because, for a start, I don't believe in them and I think it's cruel to encourage belief in them. So, I had that kind of problem. I saw The Men Who Stare at Goats, which I thought should have been more gonzo than it was and more silly than it was. But, that was okay. Let me have a look here. Did see a movie from about 1988, I believe, called Pass the Ammo, which has got Bill Paxton, Tim Curry, Annie Potts, Linda Kozlowski, and a bunch of other people in it, about a bunch of hillbillies who try to rob an evangelist headquarters and end up in a hostage situation. It's quite good and not fantastic. And it's the only movie I know where the lines, "they're going to buttfuck the preacher," appear. So there was that. I saw a low-budget vampire movie called Grave of the Vampire, starring William Smith and Michael Pataki, which is kind of interesting in a very, very low-budget vampire-y kind of way. Saw Mad Max again for the radio gig. And then the two most recent things I've seen are, of course, Cleopatra Jones. I watched that. And then I watched Coffee with Pam Grier, which I'm going to talk about today. And, of course, I also watched Charlie, with Cliff Robertson. So that's about it for that. So what I'm going to do now is take a break, get that caffeine that I promised myself, and when I come back, the interview with Sal is going to happen.
The unique wonder to the right. Dimmi quando, 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 l'anno, il giorno e l'ora in cui, forse tu mi bacerai, ogni istante attenderai, fino a quando, 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 d'improvviso ti vedrò. Sorridente accanto a me, se vuoi dirmi di sì, devi dirlo perché non ha senso per me la mia vita senza te. Dimmi quando tu verrai. Dimmi quando, 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 e baciando mi dirai, non ci lasceremo mai. Senza te, dimmi quando tu verrai. Dimmi quando, 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 e baciando mi dirai, non ci lasceremo mai. Non ci lasceremo mai, non ci lasceremo mai.
Okay, just for a bit of a change, I thought I'd test out... Okay, that's the cats going mad there. I thought I'd test out the new podcasting gear by getting a guest onto Paleo Cinema Podcast. Say hi, Sal.
Hi, Sal.
Yeah, so Sal's here, and I thought because we've got the two mics and we've got the mixer now and all this kind of groovy technology, I'd just catch up with her and see how she's doing. So when are you going to watch Casablanca with me?
2057.
Well, when I'm 100?
Yes.
Okay, why is that?
Because that would be your reward for hitting 100.
Is that right?
Yeah, I have no interest in that movie whatsoever.
You went... the Rick's Cafe Americana when we were up at Queensland at Movie World. So you've actually been in the Cafe Americana, but you're not going to watch Casablanca?
No, because first of all, you wanted to go there, and second of all, the food was crap.
The food was extremely crap, I'll agree with you on that.
Yeah, so it sort of put me off Casablanca.
So what's the first movie you can remember seeing in the cinema?
In a cinema?
In a cinema.
Oh, okay, it's either The Fox and the Hound or E.T.
Both pretty shit movies.
Hey.
Hey, what?
Both excellent movies, thank you. The Fox and the Hound was very moving.
Mm-hmm.
And
was that Disney?
Yep.
Or something, or Don Bluth or something?
Oh, hang on, I can't remember now. I think it's Disney. Bluth. I thought it was Disney.
Well, we can find out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And E.T. also very moving. And don't forget, I was like 10 when E.T. was released.
Yeah, I saw it in Dubbo with my mate Balrog.
Right.
And the guys, actually, there was a line around the corner and we were standing in the line to go in and see E.T., and the guy came out and said, any reservations? And we said, yep, but we're going in anyway.
It too was lovely. I can it even sing if you like. It was manipulative
rubbish, no, you know. Okay, the manager of this podcast stopped Sal from singing and she's having a bit of a sulk about it. But so which older movies do you like? Tell us a little bit about your kind of paleo cinema likes and dislikes.
Well, the one movie I love that is my favourite movie of all time that you refuse to boot to do on your podcast is, of course, The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, because I think that Dorothy's a whiny little bitch.
She's not a whiny little bitch. She's a scared teenage girl that was sucked up in a tornado into a weird place full of munchkins, and we all know that little people are evil.
Why?
Well, you've seen the movie. When they come up to you and start singing about, which I'm not allowed to sing, boys and girls out there in listening land, when they start singing about the Lollipop Guild and that, they're pretty scary.
No, they're scary as Leprechaun with Jennifer Aniston in it.
Jennifer Aniston is pretty scary in Leprechaun, yes.
Yeah, she's pretty scary in pretty much whatever she does.
But that was before her nose job, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was probably before all of the work she's had done. Yeah. She's had more work done on her than a restored car.
Like Anaconda's before Jennifer Lopez's nose job.
Anaconda's got a couple of virtues to it, one of which is the fact that John Voight is in it and doesn't take it seriously at all.
Well, you can't take a movie like that seriously. But anyway, back to The Wizard of Oz. It's just a beautiful movie, and it's got some great singing, which, once again, I'm not allowed to sing you any of the songs. It's just a beautiful movie. How can you not like it?
I think I like everything but Dorothy. There are aspects of the film I like. I like the technology. I like the dancing. I even like one or two of the songs. But I find Judy Garland to be too precious in a way.
But Dorothy is precious.
Why?
Because she's a poor little girl in a lost land.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean she has to whine and bitch.
Have
a little bit of balls, for fuck's sake.
She does. She goes and travels the yellow brick road and goes and looks for a way home on her own. She just happens to meet the other people on the way, but she starts off on her own.
She does not. She's got a little dog with her.
Oh, my goodness. You sound like the Wicked Witch.
I'll get you, my pretty.
I do not.
And your little dog, too.
Okay, so we're leaving aside The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
What other old movies do you like? You've seen a few with me, so, you know, you should have a little bit of an idea of which ones you liked.
if we'll go by decade, then in the 30s there was The Freaks. I remember watching that when it first came out
Freaks
in the cinemas.
Todd Brennan's Freaks, yeah. Yeah. When it first came out in the cinemas in 1930s.
Yeah, I'm actually 252 years old.
That explains a lot.
Yeah, it does. No, I like that one. That was a bit creepy, actually, when I watched that. I didn't think a movie from the 30s like that was going to scare me, but when you watch it, it's a bit...
Yeah, but there's a bit of a disconnect in that movie too, because the whole movie setup is you're supposed to have sympathy for the freaks. They're people managing in a world that doesn't accept them, and they've kind of formed a community and a family.
Mm-hmm.
And then right at the end, they're fucking monsters with magical powers.
Literally, or are we talking
literally monsters, not literally fucking.
Okay. Well, there is bits of that, but you don't say it.
Yes.
Well, they're only turned monsters because of the normal, if you can say what's normal, but the normal people were once again using them.
Yeah, but I think there's a kind of inconsistency of theme there. That's the only problem I have with that film.
Okay, fair enough. Mm. But it's creepy.
It is creepy. So, talking 1940s now.
Okay.
Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein?
Never seen it. Okay, I think, when was the Gone with the Wind?
Gone with the Wind, 1939.
Oh, damn it. I just missed out there.
You like not Gone with the Wind,
I love Gone with the Wind. I saw that with my mum when I was a teenager and thought it was just brilliant.
I didn't like it. I haven't seen the whole film. I've seen bits of it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the female lead puts me off. Vivian Leigh being like a bitch.
Yeah, but that's Scarlett O'Hara. She's a bitch.
Well, she's not even like a good bitch. She's not a film noir stylish bitch. She's just like whinging and needy and, you know, fiddle-dee-dee and all that sort of shit.
You have a problem. I'm thinking that you're a bit of a misogynist to female leads
here. I am not. I think that Ida Lupino in Roadhouse was fantastic. I think anything Thelma Ritter did is fantastic. Anything Ida Lupino did, a lot of the stuff that Rita Hayworth did. There's any number of women I've talked about on the podcast that I really enjoy their work and I like what they do, but I think the writing lets down some people in certain films.
Right. Fair enough. But, you know, everything I seem to like, you seem to hate.
No, I don't.
How do we make this marriage work?
We don't watch movies together as much as we used
That's true, people out there, listeners, dear listeners.
Yeah, but you've seen things like The Bad and the Beautiful with me.
Oh, only vaguely. I think I walked in and out on that one.
You've seen a couple of old films with me not too long ago. I'm trying to think what they are.
They must have been really good because I can't remember them.
Okay, fair enough. But so what else do you like that's kind of oldish?
Does Star Wars count?
Star Wars, God, that I could do a whole podcast ranting about Star Wars and how shit it is.
I know, that's why I mentioned it.
Yes, I know.
Everything I like, you hate. That was the first Star. No, the second one, The Empire Strikes Back,
which is the only reasonable one.
Was the one I saw? No. Pardon my, I'm getting myself a bit confused here. It was actually Return of the Jedi was the first movie I remember seeing at a drive-in.
Okay, yeah. I think there should be more drive-ins. I don't think the climate in Melbourne's kind to drive-ins.
No, it's all right. In the
wintertime, it's a bit cold. Was it you that I went? No, it wasn't you that I went to. I went to a drive-in with somebody, and I spent the whole time after the movie jumper leading other people's cars because they'd left the heater on in their car to stay warm during the winter at the drive-in. And so I spent like 2 hours jump-starting other people's cars with jumper leads.
Drive-ins didn't exist when we were together, darling.
They did. There's still one. There's still two
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, they're the only two that were still in existence.
We should actually do a drive-in together in the summertime if they end up showing anything decent there. Maybe then get down to Dramana or something down on the peninsula.
But I'll just let you know in advance, I actually go to a drive-in to watch the movie.
Oh, okay. I'm trying to think if I've seen... Oh, yes, I did see movies in drive-ins. Seen a number of movies in drive-ins. The first one I remember is I saw From Russia with Love and Goldfinger as a double feature in a drive-in, which was right. Pretty cool, and I was really unhappy because I fell asleep. I was only a little kid. I fell asleep about a third of the way through Goldfinger, just after Shirley Eaton got covered in gold and died.
Right. Well, see, it's James Bond. It's really, you fall asleep, it's going to be the same things repeated. He's going to be screwing somebody, shooting somebody, talking about some sort of stupid equipment, some criminal telling him how he's never going to escape from his plan. Then you fall asleep and you wake up and he's screwing somebody or shooting somebody or some stupid criminal telling him about how he's never going to escape.
You don't like James Bond, do you?
No.
Okay.
I hate James Bond.
Yeah, but I mean, he did cool things like shooting guys with spear guns in the Caribbean. I mean, you know, you got to love that bit.
Nah, not really. I think Johnny English was a much better James Bond than James
Who?
Bond. Johnny English.
You're saying Rowan Atkinson was a better James Bond than Sean Connery?
Yes.
I'm not sure I'm ever going to invite you onto the podcast.
I'm not Sean Connery, but he was a better James Bond than Roger Moore.
Yes, on the other hand, I mean, you know, I think that DJ Qualls would be a better bloody James Bond than
anybody, really. Even Roger I could Moore, do a better James Bond than Roger Moore.
Yeah, because Roger Moore was the saint. He wasn't James Bond, really.
Yeah.
He didn't have that.
No.
You didn't have the toughness that you need. I don't even think Pierce Brosnan did. I rewatched a few of the Brosnans recently. And even though he essayed being tough, there wasn't that essential toughness.
No, he's always going to be Remington Steele.
Well, yeah, there is that too. He kind of had that history beforehand, a bit like Roger Moore did with the Saint. Mm. But I think that Daniel Craig definitely has an essential toughness there. He's got a fighter's mug and you know, he moves like somebody who knows how to handle themselves. Which is the other thing he had in common with Connery.
Very good.
I think Timothy Dalton was the best actor as an actor, I think, to play James Bond. I think he's very underrated as an actor.
Mm.
And he kind of essayed the emotional range of James Bond a lot better than a lot of other people did. But, it's one of those things where I grew up when Bond Mania started, so I've got more of a thing. And you grew up when Roger Moore was basically a caricature of James Bond, so maybe that's had an influence on how you see it.
Yeah, I don't even recall remembering my dad watching James Bond, so I don't even know if I've had any exposure. I mean, I knew of James Bond, obviously, but I don't think I had real exposure until maybe you.
Okay, fair enough.
I think Dad watched a few if they were on telly, but he wasn't a huge Bond fanatic.
But you got that difference from me that part of your childhood there were videotapes, which I never had. I mean, I was a fully adult when VCRs came out.
Yeah, but you got to remember with my parents, we had a Betamax, which was...
That was a bad choice.
Still the best of them all, in my opinion, but it just didn't market it very well. But I recall, like, Dad... Every year, every Easter, it would be like the Ten Commandments we'd have to watch.
That's because they put it on TV. It was kind of their annual sop to religious people. At Christmas time, they'd play Rankin Bass Christmas things.
Which are just great. Easter,
they are. You've got them as well.
Yep.
And you know, Fred Astaire as an animated figure. I mean, it's wild stuff. But and then at Easter particularly, they'd show all the religious epics. I saw Samson and Delilah at the cinema. And the whole religious part of it just went past me. What I got was Hedy Lamarr looking really hot.
It's Hedley.
It's Hedy Lamarr in this case. And Victor Mature bringing down the house. And I thought, this is really rough. You know, they cut his hair off. They blind the poor bastard. They string him up in a temple.
Mm-hmm.
They're just bastards. The religious aspect, like, this particular belief system was evil. This particular belief system healed Victor Mature and made him push down a building.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff really didn't ping on my radar very much. It was just that you know, these people were nasty to him.
Yeah, I don't know why Dad was big on the Ten Commandments, being that he sort of declared himself an atheist. Well, he did grow up High Church of England, but declared himself an atheist.
Yeah. Well,
in later adulthood. But he loved the Ten Commandments. And the other big one Dad loved was Zulu. So I do like Zulu.
Yeah, Zulu was great. Mm. But getting back to the Ten Commandments for a second, I think your father might have liked it because there's an action film to a certain extent.
Yeah. It's an epic. It is an epic.
It's got that Cecil B. DeMille grandeur about it. And things like that. That's like that time I've told you about when I actually met Charlton Heston.
Mm.
And I shook his hand and I walked away and I thought, I just shook the hand that parted the Red Sea and the Ten Commandments. And I had this kind of disconnect moment of touching movie history. It's a really weird sensation.
Yeah.
But yeah, Zulu, good film. Michael Caine's career was made by Zulu and Alfie.
Yes.
And he's still going strong. He was on Desert Island Discs on the BBC recently.
Okay.
And he has got more of a contemporary taste in music than you have.
Really?
Yeah, his kids and his grandkids keep hipping him to music and he plays them and he meets some musicians at various, like he'll do a talk show and meet a whole bunch of musicians who are on the talk show. And he's really incredibly contemporary in his taste of music. It's crazy. The guy's like 73, 74.
Yeah, age is nothing when it comes to music.
Yeah.
But I do think for all Michael Caine movies, they should have put a clause in that he had to always say they were supposed to only blow the bloody doors off.
Yeah, that would have been really great in Zulu.
Bloody oath. Because that's the best line of any Michael Caine movie ever.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you could argue that, but there's a whole bunch of good Michael Caine.
I'm trying to think of any good ones came out of Jaws 4.
No, nothing good came out of Jaws 4 except for the fact that Michael Caine's check didn't bounce.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to do movies for money occasionally, don't you?
Well, the thing is that with Michael Caine, what happened was his business manager ripped him off for millions and millions of dollars and he was almost bankrupt.
Oh, I see.
So there's that arc in the mid-70s to the mid-80s where Michael Caine did anything to cash a check. And so he did things like The Hand and he did that film and a bunch of other stuff, basically because he needed to make money.
Yeah.
Because his business manager fucked him over with bad investments.
Okay. Oh, do you use bad language on this podcast?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. It's disgusting.
Okay, well, that's a nice little catch-up with you, Sal, so thanks for that. And
that's all right.
Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule of eBay.
Yes. Terry's going to put a plug on later for my eBay store, guys and girls. If you like scrapbooking or toys, visit my eBay store.
Yeah, I'll put a link onto the Paleo Cinema website for Sal. Just because I'm nice.
And because I need a hobby to keep me out of his hair when he's podcasting.
Okay, well, thanks for that, Sal. And we'll catch up again in a couple of months and let's see what you've been up to.
No problem. And please do feel free to leave feedback on how bad I was. I'd like to hear
Or this. How good she was. She's got a little problem with her self-image sometimes, but I'm glad that she came on.
No worries.
Okay, see ya.
See ya.
Okay, that was just a bit of fun Sal and I had playing around with the microphone. So I'm going to take another break now, and then when I get back, I'm going to talk about the first of the two movies that we're doing this time around, which is 1968's Charlie, directed by Ralph Nelson, and starring Cliff Robertson and Claire Bloom.
Penso che un sogno così non ritorni mai più. Mi dipingevo le mani e la faccia di blu. Poi d'improvviso venivo dal vento rapito e incominciavo a volare nel cielo infinito. Dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù, e volavo, volavo felice, più in alto del sole ed ancora più su, mentre il mondo pian piano spariva lontano laggiù.
una musica dolce suonava soltanto per me. Volare, oh, cantare, oh, nel blu, dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù. Ma tutti i sogni nell'alba svaniscono perché quando tramonta la luna li porta con sé. Ma io continuo a sognare negli occhi tuoi belli che sono blu come un cielo trapunto di stelle. Gli occhi tuoi blu, felice di stare qua giù, e continuo a volare felice più in alto del sole ed ancora più su, mentre il mondo pian piano scompare negli occhi tuoi blu. La tua voce è una musica dolce che suona per me. Gli tuoi blu, felice di stare qua giù, nel blu degli occhi tuoi blu, felice di stare qua giù.
Okay, let's talk about Charlie for a while. This is one of the classics. It's based on one of the classics of science fiction, the short story and following that the novel by Daniel Keyes called Flowers for Algernon. It's one of the great tragic stories in the genre, really. And I'll give you a bit of a background on the movie. We'll talk about the movie, but I'll kind of talk about the story a little bit as well. Charlie Gordon, Cliff Robertson, a mentally challenged man with a strong desire to make himself smarter, has been attending night school for 2 years, where he's been taught by Alice Kinnean, Claire Bloom, to read and write. However, his spelling remains poor, and he's even unable to spell his own name properly. Alice takes Charlie to the Nemo Strauss Clinic, run by Dr. Richard Nemo and Dr. Anna Strauss. Nemo and Strauss have been increasing the intelligence of lab mice with a new surgical procedure and are looking to test on a human subject. As part of the series of tests to ascertain Charlie's suitability for the process, he's made to race Algernon, one of the lab mice. Algernon physically runs through a maze while Charlie uses a pencil to trace his way through a diagram of the same maze. Charlie is disappointed that he consistently loses the race. Nonetheless, he's given the experimental surgery. After the surgery, Charlie is initially angered that he's not immediately smarter than he was before and still loses the race against Algernon. Eventually, however, he beats Algernon in a race, and then his intelligence starts increasing rapidly. Alice continues to teach him, but he soon surpasses her. So that's basically the upward arc of the plot. And short story and then the novel upon which the movie was based, as I said, classics in the genre. The short story, Flowers for Algernon, was published in 1959 in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And it won a Hugo Award at the time, so it's like winning an Oscar in science fiction circles for those of you who aren't familiar with it. And it was expanded in 1968 into a novel, into a paperback novel. Now, Cliff Robertson came along and wanted to make a movie of it. Cliff Robertson had a history with, as an actor, he'd starred in PT-109 about John F. Kennedy's wartime career. He was Moondoggy in Gidget, the first Gidget movie, and things like that. And he'd done a couple of very tough little crime dramas in the 1950s, so he's well known as an actor. He was also in the very first episode of The Outer Limits. So he was well known mostly as a television actor at the time, but he was increasingly going into film as well. So he'd actually done Flowers for Algernon as a TV drama called The Two Worlds of Charlie Gordon in 1961, so he was very familiar with the material. And in 1968, the film Charlie was made, directed by a guy called Ralph Nelson, who had a fairly middling career as a director. Some of the films that he worked on, he directed the television and film versions of Rod Serling's Requiem for a Heavyweight, for instance. He did Cary Grant's Father Goose, and he also directed Rita Hayworth's last film, The Wrath of God. So, yeah, he had an okay career. He didn't have a fantastically extensive one, but, you know, he had some chops there. And in this film as well, one of the issues I have with the film. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll play some audio from it first, and then I'll tell you about what some of the issues I have with the film. This bit's some of the scientists talking about Charlie's development, both intellectually and emotionally, and there's a little bit of them observing Charlie while he talks to Alice Kinney and the Claire Bloom character as she's testing him on the things that he's learnt. It runs about 2 minutes, but I think it's quite useful for what I'm going to say.
A capacity speed-up occurred during the high school phase, and all this work was accomplished in 3 weeks. Instructions were then accelerated.
You have been pushing him much too hard.
The subject made the leap from rote memorization to a grasp of abstract theory, with the next step that of attaining insightful function and the ability to restructure. Subsequently...
Richard, may I please have your attention? Emotionally, he's still a child. Frightened. Insecure. Look at these drawings I've had him do. They are representative of the last 2 months. Each one progressively more disturbed.
Disturbed? He likes to paint. He still can't believe that he's being paid to do nothing but learn and paint and improve.
But can't you see? I cautioned you about this before.
Well, these aren't disturbed. They're more sophisticated. More abstract than the ones he did a couple of months ago.
You go right on, ignoring even the evidence. Come. Come.
Anna, I don't think we should interrupt his studies.
Thymine, quinine, and citizen.
Structure of the insulin molecule.
Double chain, 51 amino acids employing 17 basic aminos cross-linked by sulfur atoms.
What metal and what gas would you combine in order to convert heat into electricity?
Tantalum and cesium vapor.
Yes. What is the technique called the algebra of...
What are you trying to turn me into? Some kind of a sideshow.
Now, Anna, don't be ridiculous.
You're pushing your program for his intellectual development much too rapidly. It has to keep pace with my program for his emotional development, or the imbalance will become dangerous.
Okay, there are a lot of good things about the film, and I'll talk about those after I talk about the things that I have a little bit of a problem with in the film. And you've got to remember that this thing was made a long time ago. It was made, let me do the numbers, 43 years ago. So things aren't, we live in a different culture than the people who lived in there. But one of the issues I have is that I think that when Cliff Robertson plays Charlie as intellectually disabled, I think there's a little bit of mugging there. I think that maybe observing people who are genuinely intellectually disabled might have worked a little bit better there. It plays him a bit like a kid rather than an adult with a learning difficulty. But, you know, that's an actor's choice, I suppose, and he got an Oscar for it, so he was doing something right. But one of the interesting parts I find is when Charlie starts accelerating and becoming intelligent, there's a kind of Frankenstein vitality to what he does that really is exhilarating. Now, there are some other issues with that as well, but I'll talk about some of the good things. Some of the good things about this are the fact that the acting, when Charlie becomes intelligent, Cliff Robertson does that incredibly well, that kind of upward spiral of knowledge and discovery and wonder are portrayed very well in the film. And there's a few kind of artsy-fartsy camera move moments that, that kind of work against it a little bit. And I think that maybe Ralph Nelson didn't quite have the cinematic vocabulary that we have now, given the fact that it is 43 years old. We now have techniques that enable us to show things in different ways than they were able to do at that stage. And there are bits that are a bit showy and a bit too conscious an attempt to be hip at the time. And nothing dates in movies faster than something that's trying to be up-to-date contemporary. And I think that that's maybe, we've got to kind of accept that as an artifact of the time. Now, one of the things that Charlie does do as his relationship develops with Alice Kinnear is, because he's got that lack of emotional maturity, he does try to sexually assault her at one stage. But when she fends him off, he kind of realizes what he was doing and then flees. Now, I'm not trying to justify in any way a sexual assault, but given the arc of the character where his intellectual development has outpaced his emotional development through the process of education that the scientists are putting him through, it'd almost be surprising if something like that didn't occur if you stay true to the kind of emotional core of what's happening in the story. Now, it doesn't justify it at all, and he goes away and kind of finds himself and finds his own emotional maturity by going off, getting a motorbike, having girlfriends, living life, travelling a bit, and kind of having that kind of gap year, in a sense, of his education, which lets him come back and then form a mature relationship with Alice Killian. And I think that was a kind of bold move to make. They didn't rationalize or justify the attempted sexual assault, but what they did do was say, this guy is a kind of creation of the scientists, almost the way Frankenstein is in a kind of fucked up way. And when he realized that there was something missing from the education that he needed, he went off and sought it himself and stayed away from her and felt a lot of shame about that as well. It doesn't justify it. And ultimately, Alice does fall in love with him, maybe because of who he was before he became the genius he became. Now, there's another issue in the film that I found a bit daunting. There's a bit where they kind of display him in front of a whole bunch of scientists. Now, one of the interesting things is you never actually see the faces of these scientists that are questioning Charlie. And this is the kind of emotional climax of the film. They're all backlit in shadows. They're anonymous interrogators almost, who are asking him questions about what he believes about the world and the future of the world. Sterling Siliphant, the screenwriter, goes the easy option there. He goes for the unnuanced option, but then this is some of the things that some people believed at the time this film was made. And there are bits that sting as well. Some of Charlie's predictions about the future have a bit of a sting to them, given contemporary history. But in general, they were for the kind of glib, one-liner answers to complicated questions where they could have gone for something a bit more nuanced. But it's in the relationship to some discoveries Charlie has made just minutes before he went on stage as well. So he's crying out in anger as much as anything else, rather than just giving glib pat answers. But I think there could have been, maybe with a little more thought to it, a little more depth to some of the discoveries about the nature of things that Charlie has made, because he is an extremely high-level genius at this stage of the film, more so than perhaps anyone else on the planet. And to have him utter platitudes about where he thinks the human race is going kind of plays against that kind of discovery and that intelligence that the character has. Giving pat answers, I think, can be read two ways, one of which is the writer didn't do his job right. The other one is that Charlie has suddenly discovered that he has an intense hatred and disregard for scientists who have treated him like a lab animal and are now interrogating him and questioning who he has become. And I find that quite interesting, but I think that the writing's good enough that you really want it to be better than it is. If it was just totally shit writing, I think you go, okay, it was shit writing, but you could see it kind of heading towards something and then failing at the first hurdle. And I found that a little bit of a problem with it. But having said that, they made some interesting choices in the film. The music's by Ravi Shankar, who, of course, is a sitar player and an Indian musician who was very famous for having a relationship with the Beatles at the time. And that kind of sitar music has a very kind of funky, hippie kind of approach to it at times. And it makes it different from a normal studio picture, and it was a kind of interesting choice to make there. Now, one of the things about this film is it's, in a sense, the first science fiction, it is the first science fiction film that won an Oscar for acting. It didn't win it for special effects or one of those kind of, hey, look at the pretty things we can do kind of Oscars, which films had won before that stage. But this is the first science fiction film where the acting was considered good enough. I mean, you can argue the fact whether Cliff Robertson deserves it or not, and it has been argued. But the respect given to the genre, maybe people didn't even know it was a genre film at the time. They just assumed it was a drama and a bit of a tearjerker, which ultimately it is. It is a tragic story. But I really think that it's a milestone in the genre where it's a Hugo Award-winning tale, which then went on to win an Oscar for acting. And it deserves some respect for that. Now, 43 years hindsight, of course, we can always pick it to pieces. But I think if you are a fan of science fiction at all, and if you like good drama and you enjoy seeing films of the past that are trying to do something different, then Charlie is definitely a film to see. And yeah, you're going to have bits of it you don't like and bits of it that you argue with. But overall, the story is an incredibly powerful one, and it has some things to say about the responsibility of scientists, the way people handle people with mental disabilities, the unthinking cruelty of ordinary people at times regarding people with mental disabilities. And as such, it's a quite an important film. But unfortunately, one of the things this film's done as well is it started that joke about if you want to win a big award, you've got to play a moron. That kind of thing, and you know, it's been played out in a number of comedies and things like that. I mean, of course, Jane Wyman won one for Johnny Belinda for playing a deaf person, so people with disabilities. And of course, Alan Arkin was well regarded for playing a deaf guy in The Heart as a Lonely Hunter around the same time, so there was that kind of thing of, yeah, if you play somebody with a disability, you got a better chance of winning an award. But I don't think it's really that in real life, what I think it is. And leaving aside Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man, which is kind of like a showy performance in a way, I think it really is certain types of films are made to make the audience aware of a problem in society. And these kind of movies where one of the characters does have something most of us don't to overcome, that's a worthwhile thing, even when the application of it in the film isn't really as successful as we'd like it to be. So that's about all I've got to say about Charlie. It was remade in 2000 as a TV movie called Flowers for Algernon, starring Matthew Modine. I've seen about 10 minutes of that, and it didn't really impress me much. I haven't got a lot of time for Matthew Modine as an actor. I think he's kind of a bit generic in a way, and It's. I mean, I've got a great love, and all my life I've had a love of science fiction as a literary genre, and I think this is one of the classics of that genre. And it was taken to a new level by this film in a lot of ways. So if you haven't seen it, do so, particularly if you do like science fiction and you do like movies that take you to places that movies before it have not. So I'm going to take another break now, and then we're going to get on to something that's a little more fun. Now, I didn't mean to make this too serious with Charlie. I think it has moments of joy and discovery and wonder in it, as well as that kind of tragic arc as well. And I think Claire Bloom, who first showed up in Chaplin's Limelight, in the early 1950s, is a fine actress. She's one of those actresses who's not showy in what she does, but she portrays intelligence incredibly well. So I'm going to take another break now, and then when I come back, we're going to go totally in the other direction and hit some blaxploitation funk with Jack Hill's Coffee.
They call her Coffee, because if you jab her, she'll cream you.
This is the end of your rotten life.
Coffee, the baddest one-chick hit squad that ever hit town.
All your friends are dead. Why kill them all?
Coffee, she's got a body men would die for. And lately, a lot of them have. Coffee's black. Coffee's hot. And sometimes, as sweet as sugar.
I know what you want to, and you're gonna get it.
Coffee. Always where the action is. A mean kind of super chick who don't take nothing off of nobody.
You want me to crawl? You want to spit on me and make me crawl?
See Coffee. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without a parent. Look out, Harlem. Here comes Coffee. The godmother of them all.
Gotta love those 1970s Rodney Spotsford films. I mean, that's just totally great. It's got the funk, it's got a lot of the dialogue from the film, and it just goes to town and tells it like it is, to use a term from that time. This film was written and directed by Jack Hill, who did a lot of stuff for Roger Corman back in the 1970s. He'd worked with Pam Grier before in Big Dollhouse and Big Birdcage in 71 and 72. Now, in American International Pictures, for whom this was made, Coffee, missed out on the opportunity to make it really a movie that became a really big hit, which was Cleopatra Jones in 1973, the movie starring Tamara Dobson, and went on to be an enormous hit. Blaxploitation, I think it hit a year or two before with Shaft and movies of that sort. And there was a perceived need, and why not, to have strong female roles and to maybe do a kind of Shaft type revenge movie with a strong black woman rather than a strong black man in the role. And that indeed is what happened in of course Cleopatra Jones and the sequel as well, Cleopatra Jones and the Casino of Gold. They were over the top crazy action flicks with strong female characters who were very much part of their community, who were very much not taking shit from anyone, and who would go to the extremes that characters like Dirty Harry would go, and Bullet and all those kind of, and Shaft and all those male characters who, after somebody has wronged them, would go to town on them and basically crush them into the dirt. And so Cleopatra Jones, it was all about the drug trade and beating the drug trade. And in Coffee, it was very much a similar thing. So I'll just talk about the plot of the film a little bit, and we'll go from there. Coffee Coffin, Pam Grier, is a nurse who seeks revenge for a young sister's drug-related death, product of the drug underworld, mob bosses, and a chain of violence that exists in her city. The film opens with Coffee showing her vigilante nature by killing a drug supplier and dealer. She does this without getting caught by using her sexuality as an attractive and athletic African-American woman who will do anything for a drug fix, which lures the men back to their residence and gives Coffee the privacy needed to kill them both. So that's basically it. And then she goes on to go from there to kill a whole bunch of other people and kind of work her way up the chain to stop a lot of the drug dealers and the pimps and the other people who are using and manipulating the particularly the black community in her area. And basically she goes to town on them. And the interesting thing about this is it could have been a very simplistic revenge flick, and that's not the case. They can give her a backstory, give her a history, and give her relationships, which is... No, I'm not just talking about sexual relationships, though. There are some of those, too. But real relationships, I mean, her sister's a member of the community. She's a respected operating room nurse. And they do... go out of their way. Jack Hill, who wrote and directed the film, goes out of the way to show that this kind of revenge thing is having an effect on her. She can't really function in her job as an nurse because she's been up all night after she just blew someone's guts away with a shotgun and forced his friend to OD. So, you know, there is a direct impact on her life for the things she does. She doesn't just kind of do the Zorro thing where you pretend to be somebody else all day and then at night time you go out to do your revenge gig. It doesn't really work like that in this case. It even affects her relationship with her boyfriend, Howard Brunswick, played by an actor called Booker Bradshaw, who's a city councillor. When she's making love to him, she kind of flashes back on some of the other things that have happened in the violence and finds that she can't really respond to him for that reason. So it does have an impact on the person in an interesting way. It's not kind of overplayed in that sense, but it's a little bit of part of it, and it kind of gives an interesting way of justifying what she's doing and by humanizing the character rather than just letting it be a kind of mindless Dirty Harry kind of revenge person. Coffey's very much not that. Now, there's some interesting scenes with a guy called King George, who's a pimp played by Robert Doki, who you might remember was the main cop back at the cop house in the RoboCop films, black guy with a mustache. And he's got some very funky costumes playing the back pimp. He's got a mustard-coloured jumpsuit he wears at one stage with a brown felt fedora and some very kind of early Elton John sunglasses. And then he has a great red suit. I mean, the men's clothing in this is in some ways much more impressive than the women's clothing in this film. And a lot of the women's clothing actually doesn't feature that highly because some of it does get removed at various stages during a couple of particularly interesting catfights. When Coffey gets into a bit of a brawl with King George's ladies of the night kind of thing. So she kind of works her way up the food chain of these gangsters and eventually gets to the mob boss, Arturo Vetroni, played by Alan Arbus. Now, Alan Arbus, interesting guy. Still alive, too. He's about 93 years old, but he's still alive and he only quit acting a few years ago. Up until her death, he was the husband of Diane Arbus, the world-famous and rightly famous photographer who did photographs of ordinary people and interesting people, things like that. He's her husband. And he had a little bit of a career in playing a psychologist in MASH, in the TV series MASH, because he'd met and made friends with Alan Alda, and Alan Alda got him along to a number of episodes of that, playing a psychologist in episodes of MASH. But Alan Arbus in this one is playing a very unpsychological thing. He's basically a mafia guy, not very tall, kind of weedy-looking mafia mob boss who likes to humiliate women. And that, in this film, does not end well for any man. And, there are lots of little bits of work that are great. The fact that Coffey, before she knows she's going to get into a fight with these women, hides razor blades in her hair so that if somebody tries to grab her by the hair, they're not going to come out of it better than she does. And, in fact, one of the prostitutes, played by an actress called Linda Haynes, does not do that a second time. Let's put it that way. But the thing is that these films, you've got to take them in their own thing. They were made for drive-in audiences. They were made as exploitation films, unashamedly. But in spite of the fact that it was made as an exploitation film, I think it really is praiseworthy because it does have a strong female character. It does have... even though it is doing a revenge flick kind of thing, it's doing it in a slightly different way. Black women didn't get too many starring roles in cinema in those days. I mean, of course, on TV you had Diane Carroll in Julia playing a kind of single mother looking after a kid in a sitcom. But she was possibly the whitest black character ever to be seen on TV. Because it was less threatening to the white audience that way. So she was an acceptable black person to have on television in the late 1960s. But Coffey, and of course the movie they made about 9 months after this, Foxy Brown starring Pam Grier, this movie made so much money, was so popular, that they immediately went into pre-production with another movie about a strong black woman out to get revenge. So, you know, it didn't exactly spawn a sequel, but it did skyrocket Pam Grier's career. She'd been in a couple of Women in Prison Filipino movies for Roger Corman before this, and she did a gladiator-type film, and she played a panther woman in a movie called, I think it's Beyond Twilight. I saw it recently when I was on my phase of looking through Filipino exploitation movies. Let's just see, what was it again? He said, looking this up, The Twilight People. She played Aisha, the panther woman, at around the same time, just before she made Coffee. She was also in Scream, Blackula Scream. She was an extra in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, the sequel to Valley of the Dolls that Roger Ebert wrote the script for. And kind of, yeah, but this is the movie that really kind of turned her into a minor star. And then she went on to do Foxy Brown and Friday Foster and Sheba Baby. And then by that stage, the blaxploitation thing was kind of tapering off. She played the Dust Witch in Something Wicked This Way Comes in 1983 and did some stuff in Miami Vice and a few other things, and really came back into things as Jackie Brown in 1997, the Quentin Tarantino film. Tarantino resurrected her career, and she's gone on to do steady work since then in a lot of things, and she was nominated for a hell of a lot of awards for playing Jackie Brown. She really kind of brought to it 20 odd years of acting experience, and the fact that she was, I mean, she had an advantage over a lot of the kind of stylists at the time. One, she was very statuesque, she was very forthright, and she's an intelligent woman too. She wasn't just there as eye candy in any way at all. So I think there's a story that she was actually working for Roger Corman at the time as a receptionist or something, and then kind of moved on. Let's have a look. She was hired as a receptionist at the American International Pictures Company. She was discovered by director Jack Hill, who cast her in his Women in Prison film. So she was a receptionist, so she wasn't going into the movie business particularly. She'd done a couple of little bit parts, but really wasn't going in that direction. But ultimately, this kind of took blaxploitation and exploitation films in a totally new direction. The fact that strong female characters, even if, as was the habit at the time, there were nude scenes and there were bits and pieces that nowadays actresses possibly wouldn't do. They were female roles that were very strong, which is interesting. I find that much more interesting than seeing people who kind of step easy and take the easy path on things. And these exploitation films at the time were incredibly popular and of course have had a resurgence since then. Sorry, I'm just having a little sip of amaretto here. And I've got a lot of fondness for them because, A, I saw them back in the day, so I've got a history with these kind of films. I think I even saw Coffee, if not Coffee, then Foxy Brown at the time. And along with the nudity, which as a teenage boy I appreciated a lot, I did like the action scenes. There's a fantastic car chase in this film. Not in this film. I'm kind of getting a bit mixed up here because I saw Cleopatra Jones and this film, so I could talk about them both together, and Cleopatra Jones has got the car chase. But I think that for an exploitation film from American International Pictures in 1973, the character of the main person in this film was incredibly nuanced for that time, and they didn't go the easy option, and ultimately she's walking along the beach at sunrise. She's left a witness alive too, which is something that's never discussed in the film. When she ultimately kills one of the villains, and I won't do a spoiler on that, who the villain is in this case, but after she does that, he leaves that villain's playmate alive. She's a woman upstairs on a balcony who comes down and kind of spills the beans. So you see her walking along a beach towards the sunrise and with an uncertain future ahead of her. I think that's pretty much the right ending to do for this kind of film. You can't kind of reset things back to who she was before she started this revenge kick. It's a bit of a bummer ending if you have her arrested and jailed. But if you have her kind of walking uncertainly towards the sunrise, it's kind of sets just the right tone of uncertainty and kind of bleakness. That kind of really works in this case. And it's a film that I do like, and it's a film that, while it's not Citizen Kane, has a real vitality to it. And the movie making is kind of crude. I mean, the budgets weren't enormous. It was made in something like 28 days. So, you know, there was only a certain time to make a certain amount of stuff with a certain amount of actors. And probably not a hell of a lot of pre-production on it. So given those limitations, they did a good, solid piece of exploitation cinema, and it made a lot of money at the time. So if you get a chance and haven't checked it out, or haven't checked it out lately, it's good fun and doesn't waste your time or your money.
Get yourself ready for a mean double bill. If coffee don't get you, JD will. Coffee and JD's Revenge, the baddest pair of heavyweights to ever hit the screen, with a 1-2 punch like you've never seen. Coffee, she's sweet, black, and hot. Mess with her and you're playing with fire. JD's Revenge, where a dead man's soul comes back from the grave to seek out his killer and the vengeance he craves. Coffee'll cream ya, JD'll scream ya, so take a taste of double trouble. See Coffee and JD's Revenge, doing it together to do it to you. Pam Grier, Slim Terman, and Lou Gossett Jr. in Coffee and JD's Revenge. Rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent.
Okay, we're going to start off with an email I got from Mark Brzezinski, just a quick Facebook note, in fact. So there's another great show, Terry Machine Maidens Unleashed, sounds great. Wish I'd known the ABC was showing it, I'd have tracked it down. Yeah, you can get a JB Hi-Fi online, Morris. That's an Australian site based on a shop for people overseas, and they are selling the DVD through there. I'm going to pick up my copy that way, and I hope that other people do as well. Mark Hartley, the director and producer of that, really is onto a great thing. He's also the guy who did Not Quite Hollywood, so it's very much in the same vein. And he was helped by a number of other people, including Andrew Leovold, who is probably Australia's best expert on Filipino exploitation cinema, bar none. And he's up in Brisbane and does a cult movie show on Channel 31 in Brisbane, and has been doing so for a number of years, and he's just a lovely guy and a lot of fun to chat with. Okay, got another email from Rob Kelly saying, Terry, hey, thanks for reading my email on the show. That was a great surprise. Enjoyed the latest episode, and I even learned something, the whole bit about where Jerry Siegel came up with the name Clark Kent. I knew about the Gable connection, but not the Kent part. As someone who's read comics for 35 years, it's always fun to learn something new, especially from an unexpected source like a movie podcast. I really appreciated your mention of the Twilight people. I saw it on a double bill with Pumpkinhead a few years ago. Never having seen it before, I completely fell in love with it. It's such a batshit movie, crazy movie, full of cheesy effects, Edwardian dialogue, and accidental, homoerotic subtext. I know covering it again on the show is probably overkill, but I figured I'd let you know at least one Paleo Cinema fan would be up for it if you ever wanted to talk about the film at length. Keep up the good work, Rob Kelly. Yeah, thanks for that, Rob. I'm going to put it on the list. I may not get around to it before the A to Z project is finished, but I'm in this for the long haul and I really want to continue doing the podcast. So eventually every film that people suggest will get done. I do keep a list in my little Kenny from South Park notebook. And I'd be very happy to add that to there, because it is kind of interesting. It's got a very funky, kind of loungy soundtrack to it as well, which I like. Got an email from Serbs, a.k.a. Rickster, who's a very long-term listener to the podcast. And he says, hey, Terry, I've been terribly remiss in giving you feedback on the last few podcasts. I really must apologize. Especially since I'm only now very belatedly writing about your response to my little challenge about doing a 30s and a 40s movie for the podcast. I must say, I was very surprised to see you choose Dracula, Frankenstein and the Wolfman. I wasn't expecting them. I certainly must congratulate you on making a podcast of three such overly exposed films into something very interesting and entertaining. As always, I think it's your personal reactions to the film which make Paleo Cinema such a great listen. Great job as always. As to my extended absences from commenting, I've been undergoing some hardships lately owing to the fact that I had to transfer my job briefly to Blood Island and have spent the last few months or so working on the brain of Blood Hotel and dodging tree tentacles. Which brings me to your latest podcast. What a treat to see you choose Brides of Blood as one of your B entries. Love the alphabetical undertaking, by the way. After just returning from Blood Island, it was nice to hear what the place was like back in the 60s. It sounds like not much has changed. Since I was a kid, I can remember seeing stills and movie posters from the Blood Island films in horror film books such as Rose London's Zombie the Living Dead, a book I picked up at the age of 12 during a family vacation to the Jersey Shore, if you can believe it. Although I've always wondered about them, I've never managed to see them. Even the copious amounts about them in Pete Toombs' Mondo Macabre book didn't cause me to seek them out. However, your enthusiastic mention of Brides of Blood prompted me to order the Blood Island Vacation DVD box set, so I shall be getting all four movies very soon and looking forward to a trashy good time. As indeed he should. Moving on to Bell, Book and Candle, that's a film I've been watching since I was an even younger kid on TV. Funny enough, your comments about the movie seem to echo my own feelings somewhat. I've always liked the film, but I don't love it. It's a film I've always wanted to like much more than I do, but like you, I'm still quite fond of it. I never really thought that much about what bothered me about it. Perhaps the same things you mentioned took a little of the enjoyment out of it for me. I love the look of the film, and the late 50s beatnik vibe is great. It never struck me before that James Stewart was miscast, but now that you mention it, I think you're right. Cary Grant would have been a much better fit for the film. His masterful grasp of comedy combined with the urbanity that was Cary Grant would have enlivened the film. I also agree that Kim Novak was perfectly cast. It's always puzzled me why such a fascinating woman would throw it all away by falling for a stick in the mud like Stewart in the film. Now I know the answer. She mistook him for Cary Grant. One of the things about the film I do remember always thinking was exactly what you said. Much prefer Kim Novak as the independent spirit and probably mourn for her when she turns into Donna Reed at the end. Remember how her cat Pye suddenly rejected her when she went from witch to wuss? Frankly, I'm with the cat. I've always felt that several years later she would dump Stewart and regain her magical powers. He's hoping that's what she did do. Anyway, I blathered long enough. Once again, a wonderful podcast, and it'll be interesting to see what films you choose for each letter of the alphabet. Always listening, if sometimes silent about it, Serps, a.k.a. Rickster. Serps, Rickster, thank you for that, mate. And thanks for the feedback about Bell, Book and Candle. It's a little-known film these days, but I find it quite interesting that and, of course, it does very much say a lot about the times it was made and about the studio system at the time. I think it was Columbia Pictures, this one. And that kind of arc of the particularly female character really does date it badly, and you think, why the hell would she do that for somebody like James Stewart? But yeah, Cary Grant would have been a much, much better fit for the film. So thanks for that, mate. And even if you're only commenting now and then, I know you're listening, so it's all good. And let me just see what else we have here. He said, I've got two voicemails. I'll play the shorter one first, and then we'll play the longer one, who is from the inimitable Dr. Zom.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert calling. Just have to say I'm very jealous of your Machete Maidens Unleashed viewing off TV. I wish we had that here. I'm just curious if it was totally uncut when they showed it on TV. And you said you wrote down some titles. I wondered if you could run through a few of the titles you wrote down from the documentary that you were going to seek out. Because I'm just wondering. Okay, bye.
Hey, Rupert. Thanks for that. And by the way, Rupert's blog over at Rupert Pupkin Speaks, if you type that into Google, it's the top one on this, is the one to go with. I'm just looking at the press kit for Machete Maidens Unleashed. That's probably the best place to get it. And it, I mean, they did the Blood Island trilogy, Cleopatra Wong. They talk a bit about Apocalypse Now for Your Height Only, starring Weng Weng. Let's see what else there is in there. I'm just going to have to go through them. Won't be too long. There's a lot of stuff here. He said, I'm going down the page. Okay. Big Dollhouse and the Women in Cages. That was definitely one. The Hot Box, Roger Corman's one. Ebony, Ivory and Jade, which was a bit wonderful. Let's have a look here. Night of the Cobra Woman is there. Big Dollhouse has I'm not sure if I mentioned that one. Let me just see what we've got there. Of course, the Blood Island trilogy. Savage Sisters is in there as well. Black Mama, White Mama. Let's have a look here. Savage Sisters, I mentioned. I'm just going in. The people they interview in this is fantastic. Firecracker's in there as well, which is a bit interesting. The Mothers, M-U-T-H-E-R-S, is there. The Losers with Paul Coslow. They interview him in that film as well. And let me have a look here. Oh, the people they interview. The Arena, which, of course, has Pam Grier in it. Cosa Nostra Asia and Master Samurai. They do any movie by Eddie Romero is worth looking at as well on that one. I'm waffling a little bit here, but that gives you a bit of a ground. If you go to machetemaidensunleashed.com, Machete Maidens Unleashed, one word, you're going to kind of get a very good feeling for what's out there on those. And all of them are balls to the wall action flicks and a lot of fun, not just because of that. But it's always lovely to hear from you, Rupert. You've been a great supporter of the podcast, and you're doing your own fantastic things, interviewing some incredible people over at GGTMC, Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, which I highly recommend. And again, I owe those guys a voicemail, and I will get around to it once I kind of stop getting flooded with other things that I'm doing. But, yeah, and... it's just a lot of fun to hear from you guys, particularly you, who I envy for the access that you have to some very, very interesting people to chat with. Now it's time to hear from the patron saint of Paleo Cinema, Dr. Zom.
Hey, Paleo Cinema, it's Dr. Zom. Watched a pretty good movie today. Just wanted to share as my... computer chair squeaks in the background, or at least under my butt. The movie was called Mogambo, and it starred Clark Gable. Now, this is definitely a Paleo Cinema flick, but one thing that makes it stand oot for Dr. Zom... is that I watched it on my new big screen TV, flat screen TV in HD. The movie looks really good. Not great, but I mean, it's probably the best it's ever looked. Movie stars Clark Gable, Ava Gardner, and Grace Kelly. And there's a lot of other people in there, too, but those are the three main protagonists. Love triangle, if you will. Clark Gable. He's a little bit older in this movie, but he still looks damn good. Let me tell you something. Back in the day, those studios, they may have had a stranglehold on those actors, but they sure kept them in shape and sure kept them looking fine. The two ladies, this is one of those movies where, you know, you're kind of rooting for whichever pick is your pick of the two ladies, Ava Gardner and Grace Kelly. Ava Gardner's, you know, pretty young in this, and Grace Kelly, you know, always beautiful. I, from the get-go, had to go with Ava Gardner, and that's just more or less, I don't know, the way the characters played out. Grace Kelly, though very, very beautiful, and who caught Clark Gable's eye, even though he was much older in the movie. She just, I don't know, too prissy for me, plus, you know, the fact that her husband was there with her while Clark Gable was trying to seduce her. They just kind of fell together. It really wasn't a seduction. No, it wasn't. What it was two hearts and a loveless marriage gone awry. But Ava Gardner, I like her. She had spunk. She had panache, pizzazz, and a lot of other P's, I'm sure. Yes, yes. But she kind of was stuck in hind tit on this one for quite a while. No spoilers intended here, so if you don't want to hear any more, then you probably shouldn't listen for the next few seconds, but it works out fine. Grace Kelly, you know, she just kind of had a intellectual puss of a husband, photographer, who was, you know, kind of, I don't know, not a man's man by Hollywood standards of any means. And Ava Gardner was kind of stuck there, and Clark was kind of not giving her the cold shoulder, but, you know, his interest was, of course, in the, you know, the hot, blonde, beautiful blonde. But anyway, it works out in the end. This is a good movie to watch in HD, simply because a lot of the animal scenes, and they have some really, really good stuff as far as, you know, them shooting wild animals, and looks like they were actually in a game farm over there where they catch the animals and had a little interaction with Ava Gardner and a small giraffe and an elephant and this and that. And the gorilla scene was really, you know, intense when a giant, what do you call it, a giant bull gorilla, big silverback, charged him, but it was only a bluff, and Clark knew it, so he stood his ground. But it was pretty good. I like that. It looked like they were shooting on some pretty cool locations there, got it down on film. 1953, Mogambo. Now, to go over real quick, I heard you were going to be doing reviewing Charlie with Cliff Robertson, and Cliff Robertson and that movie are kind of near and dear to my heart, even though that's Clark Gable still. I like the movie. I saw it when I was really young, and even though I was probably only about 12 years old, you know, it's a good story. I liked it. I like his evolution from being mentally challenged, and then his evolution, and then de-evolution, whatever you want to call it, regression. It was a good flick, even for a young kid. Also, another movie that with Cliff Robertson, other than 3 Days of Condor, which I really like too, is PT-109. I watched that with my great uncle, who served in World War II, and I was much younger than 12 years old. I was probably only about 7 years old, and really liked John Wayne movies and war films and things like that. And I sat down in my great uncle's little house, and we watched PT-109 when I stayed overnight one time. And that's always stuck with me. So anyway, this is Clark Gable calling from Mogambo in deepest, darkest Africa, the dark continent, if you will, saying Zom Oot.
Yeah, thanks for that, Zom. If I had a choice between Ava Gardner and Grace Kelly, I would choose both as a first option, and then Ava Gardner as a second option, and then Grace Kelly as a third option. As I said, I read Lee Server's biography of Ava Gardner, Love is Nothing, and she was an interesting woman. Troubled, yeah, but very, very interesting woman. So thanks for that recommendation, mate. Yeah, I hope you like what I said about Charlie. Interesting film, but not perfect. I think what I'm doing with the podcast now is, even if I like the film, which I did like Charlie, I want to kind of bring out the pluses and the minuses these days. I'm really kind of trying to be a little less fanboy gushy and a little more analytical about the stuff that I'm watching. And all of you guys are part of that and are helpful with it. So that's about it this time around. It's time for me to go put the saddle on the horse and ride into the sunset. Next time around is the D's. I'm going to be doing Duck Soup as one of the films. And I don't know what the other one's going to be, which is a surprise to me as well. But enjoy your movie watching. Check out the episode of Hammockus podcast that I'm guesting on. And check out the one after that as well, because I believe Dr. Zom's going to be guesting on that one. So it should be quite interesting when he does, because he's done a couple of other things in podcasts. And I've really got to try to just get something organized with Skype with Zom and try to do something there. So, but anyway, take care of yourselves, and I'll catch you soon.